Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois on October 10th on a beautiful autumn day here in the heartland. Today we have a special guest. All our guests are special, but this one particularly. We have on this show authors frequently, almost every week, someone who's an author of one kind or another. Today is an author, though, a professor who's written numerous books that, for me personally, have really been foundational for me understanding the way the Internet has developed and policies surrounding the Internet. His work has had that effect, I think, on tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people, and I hope someday millions of other people. And it is a real honor for me, therefore, to welcome Lawrence Lessig to our show. He's the professor of law at Stanford Law School, the founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. Prior to joining the Stanford faculty, Larry Lessig was the Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He is, as I've already said, the author of numerous books on the Internet and on intellectual property, including Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, The Future of Ideas, and his new book, which I hold in my hands and which I have the privilege of just having read, Free Culture. So welcome to Media Matters, Larry Lessig.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Yeah, and thanks for getting up early. You're out on the West Coast, so this is an early morning for you. And I appreciate you taking time off on a Sunday because I know you're a family man now.
That's right. My son got me up much earlier than you did.
Yeah, I figured as much. This is an hour of respite for you. So, Larry, if we could, let's just start for listeners who might not be very familiar with copyright and intellectual property. What is its role in our, just in general terms, what's the introduction? How would you explain its role, its function in our society?
Well, I believe that copyright is extremely important to encouraging a certain kind of creativity, a certain kind of creative work that otherwise couldn't be produced if they didn't have the protection of at least a limited term exclusive right, which is what a copyright gives you. So if you write a book, you get a copyright. Others can't copy the book without your permission. That makes it possible for you and, more importantly, your publisher here to be able to afford the cost of writing the book and publishing it and spreading it in a way that otherwise would be too difficult. So I think it serves an extremely important role as long as it's limited the way it has historically been, but I think recently that sense of limit has been totally lost.
And, I mean, copyright really goes back from the foundations of the modern publishing industry. I mean, it's not a new thing at all, is it?
That's right. And limits of copyright go back to the very beginning. So we followed the British in limiting copyright. And the British limited copyright in 1710 because they were attacking their own media concentration problem. At that time, there was a relatively small number of publishers in London, referred to as the Conger, who really were monopoly controllers over the spread of British culture. And the British Parliament decided they didn't want this monopoly control, so they limited the term of copyright so that works would enter the public domain and competitor publishers could publish them, and that would create a much wider range of competition in the spreading of culture. The Americans followed that model, also seeking to make sure that there wouldn't be this kind of monopoly control over the media, and unfortunately we have recently forgotten that important objective of the framers, both in the United States and also in England.
I mean, copyright's called for in the Constitution itself, isn't it?
Well, it is, but the Copyright Clause, or what I like to call it the Progress Clause, is an extremely unique clause in the Constitution. It's the only grant of power to Congress, which explicitly states its purpose in the grant itself. So it doesn't say Congress has the power to create copyrights. It says Congress has the power to, quote, promote the progress of science by securing for limited times exclusive right to authors for their writings. So the aim here is to use the monopoly to promote progress, not to use the monopoly necessarily to support concentrated media or even directly to assure some payment to authors. Its purpose is a public purpose.
Yeah, it's not to protect an industry. In other words, it's to protect the broader public.
Right. It's to create incentives to protect the broader public by making sure that people have an opportunity mm-hmm. to make money from what they produce, but therefore to create an incentive for lots of new creativity.
Now, we've got a lot of ground to cover, and I suspect we'll have our share of callers today, but just we've talked about limits on copyright early on. Let's talk more concretely. What do you mean by limits to copyright early on, and how have they changed?
Well, on the surface, it's pretty easy to describe the limits. For example, the copyright term initially was 14 years. It was renewable once to 28 years. Today,
An author or a publisher could do that with their book?
That's right. Only an author could get the copyright.
At that time?
At that time. And the author's term was limited. That term today is the life of the author plus 70 years. So if you create something in the way that, in the pattern that Irving Berlin created his greatest work, that could be a term of up to 140 years. So it's obviously much longer than it was before. But the part that's a little bit invisible in this story is that the copyright system previously, all the way until 1978, was a kind of opt-in system. If you were a copyright owner, you only got the benefit of the law if you took affirmative steps to claim that you wanted the benefit of the law.
Mm-hmm.
You had to mark your work, you had to register your work, and you had to renew the copyright after an initial term. Well, in 1978, Congress changed that so that copyright is now automatic. It's granted regardless of whether you register, regardless of whether you mark the term, and you get the full term of copyright. Now, that subtle change has had a dramatic effect on the scope of this regulation, because before, the vast majority of works were never registered, they were never marked, they instantly passed into the public domain, and those that were registered and marked, the vast majority, over 90%, never renewed their copyright after the initial term. So the vast majority of creative work was quickly passing into the public domain. But after 1978, nothing passes into the public domain, because everything is automatically copyrighted for a term all the way up to a century. Now, you might not have worried about this before the internet, when it may, you know, when everybody was enabled to participate in this process of creating and spreading speech. But now that you've got the technology of the internet that are enabling a wide range of people to speak in ways that they couldn't before, this extraordinary burden of regulation serves no fundamentally public purpose anymore. It serves only the purpose of protecting a relatively small number of publishers.
It seems also that it really shifts the burden. I mean, before 1978, you sort of could assume something was in the public domain unless proven otherwise. Now you have to assume nothing's in the public domain unless you can prove it is.
Exactly right. And the real problem with that is it's almost impossible to track down even the copyright owners. So I'm representing a web publisher out here, Brewster Kahle, who produced the Internet Archive. He wanted to put up onto the web books that had gone out of print, that were still in copyright but out of print. So we looked at 1930. In 1930, there were 10,057 books published. In 2000, there were about 174 of those still in print. So there's some 9,883 books out there that are out of print, which he wants to make available free on the Internet because he believes we ought to have a digital library as extensive as we possibly can. Well, if you go and try to find the copyright owners for these 9,883 books, there is no simple way to do it. There's no list of copyright owners. There's no registry anywhere. You literally would have to hire private detectives to see what did grandma do with the copyright when she died. Did she pass it down to Jane or did she pass it down to John? It's a totally insane and inefficient system, which is blocking an extraordinary amount of totally legitimate use now that the Internet has enabled that.
We're talking to Lawrence Lessig today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Larry Lessig is the author of numerous books, including the new book, Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. I give it a thumbs up, a massive thumbs up. I use the book, Larry, you'll be glad to know, in my class this year.
That's great.
I've used all your books in my classes. They're extraordinary works. I can't recommend them highly enough for anyone who wants to get up to speed on these issues. And speaking of the Internet, Larry, this show is not only on the NPR affiliate in East Central Illinois, but it's also carried on the Internet, and you have a fan club. We have two callers, or one caller. Our first caller today comes from Ithaca, New York. We're going to get to them in a second, but let me remind listeners, if you want to call in and speak with Larry Lessig, the phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number where we're about to go, 1-800-222-9455. Line 4, Ithaca, New York, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hello. Professor Lessig, I've been following your work since before your first book with great interest. You've given a lot of attention to the nature of innovation and creativity in the realms of cyberspace and copyright, particularly in the way that code is reused and modified in the free software realm and that creative works are ripped, mixed, and burned to create new works. There are many parallels in my field of public plant breeding, and I'm working towards redeveloping the cooperative approach that drove innovation in our profession before the biotechnological revolution and the Bayh-Dole Act. Would you comment on extending your ideas beyond copyright into similar fields which build upon the work of others, such as plant breeding?
Well, Larry, before you answer that, could I just so our listeners who might not be up to speed on all these sort of terms, could you explain what the term code means that he referred to?
Yeah, so in my first book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, I developed this real metaphor that links code in the sense of laws with code in the sense of the software or the architecture that makes the Internet function. And the basic point was that both codes, both what you could call East Coast code, the code that Congress passes, and West Coast code, the code that technologists out here make, regulate behavior. And they regulate behavior both by restricting and also enabling behavior, and that the technological code might in fact be the most important regulator that we should worry about, because it will define much more efficiently the freedoms that we have in the Internet than any law really ever could. So that was the focus in that context, and I've been skeptical in the context of the Internet of the reach of intellectual property laws, not because I'm against patents or copyrights in principle, but because I think that they tend to get bloated by really special interests who have not the public interest in mind, but their own particular clients. Now, in the context of biotechnology, I'm never quite sure whether this is a product of lobbyists or just an unintended consequence of the way the law developed. But what's happened is the patents in the context of plant breeding and in the context of the whole really development of food in a massive number of context has led to an extraordinary concentration in the industries that facilitate this agribusiness. And, you know, whereas we had lots of individual competitors even just 10 years ago, the explosion of patents in this context has forced all the competitors to buy each other because the patents are so complex and so difficult to negotiate. The simplest way to negotiate is just to buy the company that holds your competing patents. Now, that is totally contrary to the objective of a competitive market, which is to have lots of competition, lots of competitors. But, you know, the lesson that I draw from it is the really dangerous consequence that can flow from these monopolies handed out by the government. And it's a special reason why we have to be careful that they're doing more good than harm. And again, the reason why our framers explicitly said the purpose of patents and copyrights is to promote progress, not to make sure agribusiness has a great year next year in their bottom line.
Caller, do you have a follow-up to that?
I was wondering if you could maybe further comment in the context of publicly funded research and how the current situation, as you described, with a kind of mega agribusiness has lessened our ability to do our work in the public sector. If you have any comments on that, then I'll.
Yeah, I mean, you tied this earlier to the Bayh-Dole Act, which I think is an important link. The Bayh-Dole Act passed in the early 1980s, made it possible for people receiving public funding to do research to patent the work that they had produced using this public funding. So in a certain sense, they were getting two bites at the apple. On the one hand, they were getting money from the government to do their research, and once they produced some invention, they were allowed to get a monopoly from the government to exploit the value of that invention. Now, when Congress did this, they were convinced that this was necessary to create incentives for researchers to do research, or more importantly, to bring their inventions to market. But the unintended consequence of this is that it has radically changed the way research is done. Because before the explosion of patents in this context, researchers were quite open about sharing their results and spreading the inventions which they discovered, because all they were trying to do was to become well-known as successful researchers. Now the lawyers stand over the shoulders of the researchers and tell them, well, you can't write a paper about that, or you can't share your results about that, because it'll interfere with our ability to get patents, and patents have become or at least perceived to be an extremely important asset for the university. So it's changed the way research is done. And that has inspired the kind of public research movement that is going on in a number of contexts. One is the open access publishing movement in science, where scientists are beginning to say, look, we write these papers, we give them to publishers for free. There's no reason publishers should be charging our universities tens of thousands of dollars to buy subscriptions to the journals that have our research results in it. So we're going to try to spread our research freely and broadly using different ways of publishing. And I'm working with Public Library of Science, which is one of the leaders in this, to guarantee research is available internationally for free. And that's the same thing that's being pushed in Congress right now. There's a bill considering cases where the NIH funds research. They need to require that the research is available freely and universally so that the government doesn't pay for discovery of ideas that then turn out to be sources of profit for not the public interest, but private interest. So I think it's extremely important, and it's related to the issues that I was talking about in free culture. Free culture is about the unintended consequence and sometimes intended consequence of this massive monopoly regulations of copyright. But the same issue is being produced in the context of science through the unintended consequences of patents.
For those of you who have just tuned in, our guest today on Media Matters is Lawrence Lessig, the author of Free Culture, a brand new book that's come out by Penguin Press. The subtitle is How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. Larry Lessig is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and one of the best-known scholars on intellectual property and the Internet in the world today. And we have a full bank of phone callers, and we're going to get to you all. But before we do, I just want to let our listeners know that next week we're having a special two-hour Media Matters from noon to 2, not from 1 to 2. We're going to have John Nichols on, and it's a two-hour discussion of media and the elections. John Nichols covering all the elections for Congress and the presidency this year and monitoring media coverage of the candidates. So we'll be talking media and politics as we gear up for the November 2 elections. 2 hours next week, noon to 2. And just coincidentally, as you might guess, it's pledge drive time here. So make sure you call with your credit card numbers when you call to talk to John Nichols next week. Our phone number is here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Indiana, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hello. Two questions. First of all, I hope it's apropos, and the information I got was way at the tail end of it, but it was my understanding that Fox News tried to copyright the phrase fair and balanced, and I never did hear anything more about it. Second question is, right now in biotechnology, and especially with our pharmaceuticals, is my understanding, at least from the news, that the NIH does a lot of funding for the beginning parts of finding new drugs. Then when they get it to a certain level, they move it in over to private organizations. And if that's true, I'd wonder if you'd make a comment about the situation on patent and copyright there. Thank you.
Sure. Let's start with the second one first.
Okay.
It is true that NIH does a lot of funding to try to get basic research done, which otherwise wouldn't be done, wouldn't be supported by the market incentives supporting drug research.
What does NIH stand for, Larry?
The National Institute of Health.
Okay.
And so their objective is to try to spur innovation in places otherwise wouldn't happen. I think one of the problems, this is related to the last question, one of the problems we've got here is there's not a good understanding yet about how to limit the extent of the incentive the NIH is creating, especially when they start supporting research that gets privatized and used in patented ways and blocks others from being able to build on top of it. There's a bill trying to push the NIH to make sure that a lot of the results are available freely, independent of the patents, even just published freely, and I think that would be an important reform here. With respect to Fox, that's right. What Fox did really at the behest of Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly was very upset because the phrase fair and balanced had become a trademark of, or is claimed to be a trademark of Fox. And Al Franken wrote a book and had a subtitle that was using that what was said to be a trademarked phrase. And so they sued Franken and the publisher Dutton, claiming that it violated the trademark by using the Fox name. Now, it was an insane suit. It was totally baseless, and the court quickly threw it out. But it did create a fear about Fox, which is, would they use the legal system to shut down people who criticize them? And Bob, of course, is becoming world famous because of his participation in a film about Fox called Outfoxed by Robert Greenwald, which is an attempt to demonstrate really how fundamentally biased this network is, and really how it's lost any credibility as a journalist, as journalists in the context of its news department. But in the context of building that film too, there was a lot of anxiety about whether Fox would use the legal system to shut down criticism. And very importantly, immediately after this film was released, you know, a film that's criticizing Fox because of its bias, and so you would think their real concern was to make sure to meet the charges of bias. Instead of meeting the charges of bias, what Fox's first response was to try to rally the other news networks against Greenwald and against filmmakers who would use clips from Fox News or any news story to tell their critical story about the news. The claim here was, if they didn't stop this practice, then we would have all sorts of people out there trying to criticize the news using clips from the news, and that would be a threat, a quote, threat to journalism, as Roger Ailes said. Now, I mean, that's insane. The idea that you're not allowed
even pass the giggle test.
Yeah, exactly. The idea you're not allowed to quote journalism in order to criticize it, that's a threat to journalism. You know, that's a threat to free speech. And so here's another example where the overreaching of copyright law really creates a chill over the opportunity of people to participate in political discourse in a way that really advances understanding of the issues at stake.
It seems that the point you were getting at earlier deserves to be returned to, which is that, you know, what copyright grants is a monopoly privilege over an idea or some creative work. And, I mean, it's anti-competitive. It's anti-free market by definition. I mean, so that's the danger that's built right into it.
Exactly right. And that's why, you know, for most of the early part of our history, nobody talked about copyright really as property. They talked about it as a monopoly, right? And when you talk about it as a monopoly, the intuition that the government should be limiting it is very clear. You know, it's very hard to get people riled up about the fundamental right you have to the government supporting your monopoly. Whereas, you know, when you talk about it as property, people are like, of course the government should be supporting your property. But that simplifies it really in a fundamental way. And what we have to do is to get people to recognize the dangers in a system where powerful media can go to the government and get the government to protect them through copyright by, you know, using a very strong copyright to protect themselves from criticism or to give them an opportunity to corrupt the political process by this device that protects them from criticism.
Just 2 weeks ago, and this is a good point to mention this, we had on the air David Wallace, who's a journalist, talking about his book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, which was a collection of articles that were killed by our newspapers and magazines in the United States over the past 10 or 20 years. Wallace will be appearing in Bloomington Normal in the very near future. In fact, on October 14th, this Thursday, at a conference called Killed, Censorship of the Press at Illinois State University. And if you just go to indy.pabn.org, you'll get all the information, indy.pabn.org, for the conference Killed, Censorship of the Press at Illinois State University, which will feature David Wallace, who was a guest on Media Matters 2 weeks ago. Our guest here today is Larry Lessig, Stanford Law Professor, author of the brand new book, Free Culture. Larry, what's your website again?
Well, mine is at lessig.org, but you can get a free copy of Free Culture at free-culture.org. My publisher was so convinced by the book that it agreed to allow it to be released free online under a Creative Commons license, and so you can get it in PDF form, or actually people have produced all sorts of other formats, and that's also available on my website.
Okay, well, terrific. Let's go back to the phone lines. Now, the phone number here, by the way, if you are interested in calling and speaking with Larry Lessig, 333-9455, toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hi. I have a question about using the term intellectual property. Happen to be speaking of property. Shouldn't we be walking away from that term and identifying what it is we're talking about, copyright versus trademark versus patent versus mask rights or what have you? And also, I'm hoping that Professor Lessig will show up at Ebert Fest. I'm hoping Ebert will invite him to talk there, because we really could have used you last year at Ebert Fest when Jack Valenti was making his publicity tour of a bunch of college campuses talking about, quote, piracy and, quote, theft.
Yeah, I'm sorry I wasn't invited to Ebert Fest, and I would love to go.
Are you familiar with Ebert Fest, Larry?
I've just heard of it. I mean, I saw something really from 2002. I didn't know anything about it from before, but there was a... Well, anyway, yeah, I know a little bit about it from that context, but the first question about the word intellectual property is really a hotly contested issue, and I go back and forth both ways. On the one hand, you're right. If you talk about it like property, people have a very simplifying idea. They think it's like your car, and of course there's no fair use right to use your car. Why should there be a fair use right to use Fox News? But on the other hand, when we walk away from talking about copyright and patents as intellectual property, we take off the pressure that should exist on regular property too, because the fact is all property is limited, whether it's tangible or intangible. You know, if you have a sidewalk on front of your house, that in a certain sense is interfering with the property right that you have to your house, but that limit is enforced by the state, and if you put a fence to block access to the sidewalk, you'd be violating the property rights of the public there. So on the one hand, I think it's valuable to remind everybody that there's limitations on property rights everywhere. There has always been. That's an extremely important part of making sure that property systems function well. And the other reason to link them together is really the converse of the point that the caller was making about the differences between copyright and trademark and patent. Sometimes it's good to remember the similarities just to show how crazy the copyright system has become. So copyright and patents began about the same length of term. Initially, the term for patents was 14 years, and copyright was 14 years, renewable to 28. Now they're wildly different. The patent term is just 20 years, and the copyright term is life of the author plus 70 years. It would be good to remember the similarity here to begin to point out the craziness of the copyright term. Or similarly, patents and trademark both require registration, both require a kind of affirmative step taken periodically to continue to get the benefit of this government-granted monopoly, but copyright doesn't. And by pointing out that copyright is the only regime, traditionally called intellectual property, that does away with those formalities, we can begin to think a little bit critically about exactly why it does that. And so I go both ways on it. Richard Stallman, who's, of course, one of the most important supporters of free culture, he started the free software movement 20 years ago this year. He's a very strong opponent of the word free intellectual property, and I respect his criticism. But I think it's a good thing to focus on really how property needs to be limited generally and how copyright among the class of intellectual property has become insanely expansive.
You know, go ahead, caller.
Speaking of Richard Stallman, he's got an essay called Understanding Copyright, I think, or something like that, in his book talking about the free software movement. And part of it takes a very critical view of the idea of a balanced copyright, saying that when we look at copyright in a balanced way, what we end up doing is talking about something that favors corporations, multinationals like Disney, Viacom, and not something that favors ordinary citizens like you and me.
Well, I really would urge people to read Richard's writing, and if you go to the Free Software Foundation's webpage, fsf.org, you can find it. I think he's correct empirically that this is the way the debate has developed, but not because something about the words leads you that way. It's developed this way because there's something corrupt in the political process. The political process has been so captured by lobbyists in this context that politicians can't even hear the other side of this debate. So it's not because the words balance have led us down the wrong path, or even because the words intellectual property has led us down the wrong path. It's because the political system has driven us down the wrong path because we don't have a good way to get politicians to listen to the other side. They don't even understand there's another side to this debate. And that's the really first important step that's got to be taken if we're going to achieve something like reasonableness in this context.
Now, Larry, you've already talked about the 1978 change in copyright law, and we had, of course, a couple of major changes in the 1990s that were driven by industry and industry lobbyists. What percentage offhand, and obviously you don't know the answer exactly, but if you would guess, what percentage of the American population had any awareness that these copyright debates were taking place in Washington?
Oh, extremely small. The latest radical changes happened in 1998. That's when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was passed, and also the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. And you know, and that was the Sonny Bono Act was the statute that I volunteered to help Eric Eldred challenge, and we went to the Supreme Court, and of course lost in the Supreme Court. But when we first brought that case, challenging the extension of existing copyrights, nobody understood what the issues were about. Nobody in the press understood what the issues were about. It was a kind of corruption of the political system that lobbyists could lobby to extend the term of existing copyrights, and nobody had any real strong opposition. But by the time we got to the Supreme Court, that had all changed. People had begun to be aware of the issue. People had begun to recognize that this was yet another example of how special interests control our political process. Increasingly, they began to recognize that there was no good reason to justify extending the term of these copyrights. And especially when you begin to see what this does systematically to the opportunity of libraries and schools to make our culture available. When we lost in the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer wrote a very strong dissent. And he said in the dissent, 98% of the works affected by this extension are no longer commercially available at all. 2% are available commercially, and they're the ones that benefit from copyright extension, but 98% is not available commercially. So if you wanted to be able to spread or get access to the 98%, putting it up on the internet or something like that, again, you'd have to go through the extraordinarily complex system of copyright to clear permission to do it first. Otherwise, you would be called by Jack Valenti and others a pirate. Now, the point is that this political system is not even understanding how much harm it's doing here because it's so enamored of the Hollywood perspective that we ought to be extending terms forever and protecting copyright more and more extremely. And what it needs in this debate is a recognition by wider range of the public of just how insane the system has become and begin to demand some balance again, Richard, notwithstanding, balance to assure that we get sensible laws, which I think we had for most of our history until the lobbyists began to control the process.
I mean, are there any political figures in Washington, members of Congress on the relevant committees, who have been willing to step forward and work on this issue and go against these lobbies, or is it pretty dark still?
Well, there's a relatively small number, and I would say that, you know, the most important of these would be people like Congressman Boucher, mm-hmm. From Virginia, who has been one of the real leaders in getting Congress to recognize the extremism that they have developed in this context. So Boucher is a very important one. In my own district, Zoe Lofgren has been an extremely important supporter of sensible policies in this context. And what's interesting is it's not just people on the left or people on the right. I think what increasingly happens is that people on the both Republicans and Democrats together recognize that there's something really imbalanced about this existing system that needs to be checked, both by limiting the extent of the monopolies that we're giving out, and also by protecting the public domain, because both people on the left and the right recognize that the only people being benefited by this existing system are a relatively small number of corporate interests that really are exploiting their power to restrict public access to content. And that's not really something that either conservatives, who typically don't like Hollywood much, or liberals, who want to make sure that the public has a really valid and strong right to speak, support. So I think that we're beginning to see a broader range of support on these issues, but it's going to take a lot more.
We're talking to Larry Lessig today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lawrence Lessig is the author of many books, including the new book, Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. It is an exceptional book. I urge you all to read it. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're about to get back to two callers who have been very patient, and please bear with us. But I do want to follow up on one point, Larry. How is copyright handled in other countries with similar political economies to ours? And what's the global nature of regulation of intellectual property?
Well, there basically are two really different traditions in intellectual, in copyright, at least. The United States tradition, following English, was a very limited tradition that granted rights only if the authors claimed them and granted them for relatively limited times. The European tradition was much more expansive. It located the right as almost a kind of human right in the author, but granted the right whether the author took any formal steps to claim it or not. And the United States has more and more moved to the European model of intellectual property. That was the really significant change in 1978 when we adopted the basic form of protection that the Europeans had been granting and supporting in something called the Berne Convention. Now, the United States is really the leader now around the world, pushing governments around the world to accept ever more restrictive IP protections. And the most grotesque feature of this is in the context of developing nations, where the United States is, as a condition of getting access to U.S. markets, forcing these nations to embrace an extraordinarily restrictive IP regime, much more restrictive than anything we ever had to suffer, right? The United States didn't recognize foreign copyrights at all for the first 100 years of the American Republic. But now we go around and tell other developing nations they need to respect not just the level of protection that we insist on, but often a more restrictive level of protection than we even impose on ourselves. So we force the Chinese to adopt a system of IP that are actually more restrictive than United States law. And that's really, again, driven by the corruption of a political process here, where the United States Trade Representative is responding to just one narrow set of interests here, the interests of the content industry, and not thinking either more globally about what's in the interest of the global economy or more globally in the United States about what's in the interest of technology and innovation more broadly than in just the narrow content industry.
Now, I can see clearly where there's going to be a conflict between the global south, third world countries, underdeveloped economies that don't have a lot of content being protected right now, that want access, do not want to be restricted by intellectual property rules. How about the major European powers? Does the United States have conflicts there too, or are they pretty much on the same page?
Well, they're pretty much on the same page. There's a little dance that goes on between the United States and Europe. This was in the context of terms, this was most obvious. Germany extended the term to life plus 70 first. And then the Europeans began to think that they needed to harmonize around life plus 70. Now, they were encouraged to think that by American lobbyists who went over and told them, you ought to have a single term for all of Europe. Well, when Europe adopted life plus 70, then the lobbyists came back to the United States and they told Congress, well, we need to harmonize on Europe. So that's what got us to life plus 70. But when we went to life plus 70, we actually extended the term for certain kinds of works beyond the European term. So recordings are protected longer in the United States than in Europe. So now the Europeans are considering extending their term again to match the extension the United States did. The United States extension, of course, initially intended to match the extension Europe did. So there's this spiral of increasing protection, one following the other, which is really being orchestrated, again, by a relatively small number of content industry lobbyists whose single objective is to expand IP as broadly as they possibly can. Now, until politicians wake up to this, they'll succeed. And the consequence of it is that we had an extraordinarily rich public domain, which which kept the cost of spreading culture down and made it possible for people to build on culture broadly and use it to criticize, even in the context of politics, we will not have that public domain for the next 100 years because we've so fundamentally changed the rule that it just doesn't exist right now.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Champaign County, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen. Actually, the international dimension was one of the 2 points that I wanted to raise, and you just did a very good job of raising that. One thing I wanted to point out, just supplementary, is that a lot of this is being done at WTO. Consequently, it doesn't have any transparency, so we don't even see where these arguments are being made. Some of it's in the public, and as you say, some of it's this bilateral kind of thing between Europe and the U.S. But one of the effects that I see is particularly vis-a-vis Canada and places where they have two languages, the U.S. Is objecting to any kind of, you know, content quotient of various languages and internal production, too. So that's one of the contested grounds, I guess. But the other thing I thought might be productive would be just kind of an illustration of how this lobbying works. And one of the big examples is Disney and Mickey Mouse. And I don't know, maybe that one's been done too much, or whether you have any kind of way of showing how this has happened in an anecdotal way. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, in fact, that's a great way to put it, because I think we've been talking somewhat abstractly here. And in your writing, you do a wonderful job of giving concrete examples constantly to really bring home what's at stake. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, some of the examples of, you know, what's at stake with the, you know, these new versions of copyright and these new limits that are being put in place.
Well, I mean, the example of the Mickey Mouse is exactly what drove the challenge to the Copyright Term Extension Act in 1998. You know, Disney, when Disney created Mickey Mouse, lived in a much freer culture where he was able to build on the work of others much more freely, both because the works passed into the public domain quickly and because the legal culture enabled people to be freer in the way they built on other works, right? At the time, before 1978, the average term of copyright was never more than 32 years, meaning just a generation and a half before, stuff was free for people to build on. And if you think about Disney's work, the vast majority of Disney's work is work that was built upon work in the public domain. Well, the rules have changed now so that essentially nobody can do to Walt Disney what Walt Disney did to the Brothers Grimm, right?
Mm-hmm.
The term now goes on forever, and if you ever got near Disney works, you're sure you'd be very quick to meet Disney lawyers. So, you know, that's a particular example of how the system has changed pretty dramatically. In the context of international concerns, I think there's, you know, the example that's most disgusting in this context was the efforts by the United States to stop countries around the world from finding ways either to parallel import HIV drugs that to deal with the AIDS crisis, or even to license them in a compulsory way. Now, again, this wasn't a Republican policy versus a Democratic policy. The first limitations that the United States started imposing in this happened in the late 1990s under the Clinton administration, where we took steps to stop South Africa from facilitating parallel imports or even compulsory licensing of HIV drugs to deal with huge crisis that exists in throughout Africa with AIDS. Now, you stand back from that and you say, what exactly will our children think of us when they look back on us and say, wait, you stopped the flow of information into Africa to enable them to deal with a crisis that is killing 15 to 30 million Africans in the name of what? Why did you do that? Like, what is the thing you're trying to protect? Because, of course, stopping the Africans from producing drugs to deal with AIDS isn't going to help U.S. drug companies because, you know, obviously they can't afford the prices the U.S. drug companies pay for those drugs. Instead, it was driven by this kind of very simple idea of the importance of the, quote, sanctity of patents or property. And it's that unthinking consequence that I think, you know, it's going to take some really strong political recognition to get people to wake up to.
But Larry, we've got a full bank of callers and only a handful of minutes left, so let's try to get through them if we can. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
This is an incredible conversation that ties in with the political nature of the world today. I'm calling primarily because I'd like to mention the name of Eric Fromm, who was a radical humanist and philosopher who wrote an important book called To Have or To Be. And he discusses the nature of society as really being a dichotomy of our relationship to property and property rights. And he describes a certain having mode as being tied to property rights, and says that the problem with this type of a culture is that it doesn't require owners to make productive use of their property. I don't know, Mr. Lessig, if you're familiar with this writer. You have a conservative background and are tied with conservative institutions, but I found it very interesting that you described how the environment we live in is not listening, and how you even described earlier as insane. And Eric Fromm was concerned with the sanity of the world. And I wonder if you might comment on that, or if you're familiar with Eric Fromm's work, a very important book, To Have or To Be.
Thank you, caller.
It is true that, I've spent a lot of my time working for conservatives, never quite a conservative myself.
We're going to call you a conservative, so anyone who complains about my show, I can say I'm pretty unbalanced.
That's right. But I think that, using words like sanity or insanity here does show not just that this is a problem for people on the left, but it's also a problem for people on the right. And I do think that if we can just focus on some common sense about this and stop thinking about it in this extreme political way, we would make progress on it. So Eric Fromm's work, I think, is useful and does speak to a certain range of thinkers about this issue.
Let's get back to the phone lines if we can, Larry, because we have a couple patient callers. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, I'm on line 2?
You are.
Okay, I thought I was on line 3. Yeah, a few minutes ago you were talking about, what brought to my mind intertextuality, the whole history of literature and intellectual tradition where we take something that was already created, we don't create things out of nothing, and then we may spoof it or parody it or mock it or satire it or subvert it or reverse it. And I'm wondering if some of this kind of play is endangered by some of these copyright laws.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the fundamental thing we've not recognized.
Yeah, this is in the heart of your work, just so callers understand. If you read any of Larry's books, especially Free Culture, this theme has gone into in great depth.
Yeah, and the reason it's threatened is that all of the kind of remix that we all have done since the beginning of human culture was essentially unregulated before the Internet because it was, in a sense, outside of the reach of the law. But when you try to do this intertextuality remixing of all sorts of culture, especially video and sounds, in the context of the Internet, then the law kicks in, regulates you directly. And at least the extreme way that the law is developed right now, it's no longer possible for you to do this without fearing the legal regulation on top of you. Now, that I think that's insane, again. I think that is wildly beyond the purpose of intellectual property law to be regulating this kind of creative work, and yet it does. And the thing to focus on is when it stops people from remixing and re-expressing our culture, it's not stopping pirates. What it's doing is it's stopping the very process by which culture gets made. And until we can distinguish between the problem, and I agree it is a problem, of people taking content that is not theirs, verbatim copies, and the problem of encouraging people to engage in this remix, then we will not make progress in this debate.
Well, let's go to our last caller, Line 3, Champagne. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hello? Is that me?
That's you, sir.
Yes, this is a fascinating conversation. I appreciate talking with you. I'm concerned, though, that you gave property rights maybe second-class citizenship compared to tangible property rights when you told one caller that you can't license or get royalties for your automobile, which you own. It would seem to me that intellectual property rights could be equated to the creativity or the creation of a product, perhaps, or something that is tangible that I could sell, and that the royalty that you get for creating something intellectual, whether it's a patent or a copyright or music or whatever, is a substitute for being able to sell a tangible right. And in a sense, you're getting rent for it instead of selling it for the present value, maybe, of the future stream of rent.
Right. I actually like to think about them as the same thing. And I think there are limits in real property as well as limits in intellectual property. But I like to get people to see how the law doesn't treat them as the same thing, right? So if you buy a table, there's no right. There's no question that you have the right to put the table in your living room or maybe in your dining room or maybe in your den. But the difference is if you buy a song and you want to use it in a different way, for example, remix it with your video of your kid or to put it in a different mix of collage for something you want to display to your kid's school, you don't have the same right to do that. You've got a clear permission. You've got to ask permission for these other uses. And the point is that burden of being able to engage and use culture in a way that is productive limits productive reuse of culture in the way it doesn't limit productive reuse of regular property. So I think we can think about them as the same, and we'd actually make a lot of progress in restricting the unhelpful, burdensome limitations that exist upon creative work.
You're listening to Larry Lessig today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Before we close up the show today, let me remind our listeners, if you'd like to get a weekly email update from our producer, Victor Picard, on who our guest is, links to their website, to their works, like in the case of Larry today, all you need to do is send an email to Victor Picard, which is at vpicard@uiuc.edu, and you will get the weekly update and the links, and you get no junk spam, nothing like that, and you can get off it whenever you want. But we have several hundred people doing it now, and they seem to enjoy it. It means you can, you know, find out what you want to know about our guests whenever you want, and also be alerted to who will be on the upcoming show every week. Next week, we've got the two-hour marathon show with John Nichols on media and elections. I urge you all to stay tuned. And Larry, you know, we're just about to wrap up. We've only got a few seconds left. What are you working on now?
Well, my biggest work is in the nonprofit we run called Creative Commons, which is trying to make it easy for artists to express the freedom they want others to have with their content. So if you go to creativecommons.org, you can see the work with that we're doing there. And more generally, just to get people to talk about these issues politically, there's a wonderful new PAC that started called IP or IPAC. You can see it at ipaction.org, which has picked three candidates from the Democrats and three candidates from the Republicans who have some good thoughts about these issues and deserve to be supported. So my work is trying to, you know, get people to recognize this issue and talk about it so that it doesn't become controlled solely by these lobbyists.
Larry Lessig, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. We'll have to get you back again as often as we can. Larry Lessig is the author of Free Culture, the new book just out by Penguin Press. I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host of Media Matters. We'll be back in 166 hours with John Nichols. Thank you very much, and thank Victor Picard, my producer.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye, Larry.